Manjakopaturubhyascha Kripasindubhaivacha Patitanam Pavanebhyo Vaishnavebhyo Namo Namaha. Come in. I mean, go away. I mean, either. Either come in or go away. It's Varuni and Lilamrita. Or the mice in the walls, or what is it? We read the first chapter of the fifth canto last week, and we heard about Priyavrata, how Priyavrata was fixed in renunciation, and there was a need for him to take up the work of ruling the kingdom. And Lord Brahma approached him, explaining this was Krishna's desire that he do this. So he gave up renunciation. He renounced renunciation to please Krishna. And he took up the most opulent of positions. The most opulent meaning the position of king that places one in touch with wealth, fame, power, etc. So he ruled, and it seems, according to the descriptions, that he could have even gotten entangled, despite the fact that that Lord Brahma told him that you have my blessings in this. And it's actually quite interesting. His question, Priyavrata's question, while still a renunciant to Lord Brahma, to Manu, his father, when his father asked him to take up the position of ruling, he asked his father, "May this endanger my spiritual life? Getting involved in all this power business, money, power, politics, fighting, this that." And Lord Brahma, again, explained, this is Krishna's desire that you do this. So, he was aware of the risk, Priyavrata was, and yet, to please Krishna, to please his superiors, he took up the service. And he did it exceptionally well, with such power. He also married and had seven powerful sons. And there are three verses at the end of this chapter that describe the activities of Priyavrata, the glorious activities of Priyavrata. And the last one, perhaps, is the most glorious activity. We'll read that too, one in order. So the first one, text 39. There are many famous verses regarding Maharaj Priyavrata's activities. Here's the first one. No one but the Supreme Personality of Godhead could do what Maharaj Priyavrata has done. Maharaj Priyavrata dissipated the darkness of night, and with the rims of his great chariot he excavated seven great oceans. Prabhupada's purport, we'll read a bit of that. There are many excellent verses famous all over the world concerning the activities of Maharaj Priyavrata. He is so celebrated that his activities are compared to those of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. By his serving Krishna, he attained power. Not that it was his desire, but by serving Krishna, he obtained power that he could do things only. He could do things that only Krishna could do, practically speaking. He gained so much power by this, by his service to Krishna. So that is so wonderful. How wonderful is service to Krishna? Second verse. To stop the quarreling among different people, Maharaj Priyavrata marked boundaries at rivers and at the edges of mountains and forests so that no one would trespass upon another's property. So he practically ruled as the king as well, because without having a proper king or ruler, there's so much difficulty in society. There's actually a mention of that, not in this verse, but in the next, I think in the next chapter. The example set, Prabhupada's purport, the example set by Maharaj Priyavrata in marking off different states is still followed. As indicated here, different classes of men are destined to live in different areas, and therefore the boundaries of various tracts of land, which are described here as islands, should be defined by different rivers, forests, and hills. So one can get beyond, one can transcend dealing with people other than of one's own nature or culture. It is definitely possible to do that. But amongst general people, the people in general who are not fully transcendental, unless they deal with people who think and act and have the same cultural habits that they do, they'll always be fighting and bickering because of the different ways of dealing with the world, the different etiquettes, the different social conventions. So therefore, to make the world peaceful, not expecting every different type of person to be able to get along with every other type of person. No. Much more practical than that was Maharaj Priyavrata. And therefore, he divided the areas into different, the world, practically speaking, into different areas where different kinds of people could live. And the boundaries of those areas were natural boundaries, such as rivers, forests, and hills. Right at the end of the purport, Prabhupada says, Maharaj Priyavrata divided the surface of the globe into different islands so that each class of men would live peacefully and not clash with the others. The modern idea of nationhood has gradually developed from the divisions made by Maharaj Priyavrata. So one who is transcendental, one who has pure consciousness, pure spiritual vision, when he looks at another, what does he see? He sees a soul. He sees the activities of the soul. He doesn't see the cultural distinctions. And therefore a transcendentalist can deal with anyone. He deals with compassion with everyone. He deals with knowledge with everyone. He deals with understanding. But for ordinary people, this is not possible. Not possible. Not only not practical, it's not possible. For transcendentalist, Vidyavanaya Sampane, Brahmani Gavi Hastini, Suni Chaiva Swapaki Cha Pandita Samadarshana. That he not only sees the spiritual nature of every human, but when he looks at an animal, be it a dog or a cow or a lion or an elephant or a low-class person or a high-class person, he doesn't see the distinctions of their karma and their bodies. What does he see? He sees the fact that there is a soul. Pandita, the learned person, Samadarshana, he sees equally everyone, regardless of the body that they happen to inhabit. And he sees that in every body, the life of that body is the soul. The consciousness that that body has, and we say, oh, that person's alive, or that tree is alive. When we see a dead tree, we recognize it, or a dead plant, or a dead animal, or a dead person. Immediately we recognize it. So the wise person, when he sees a live person, he doesn't think that the life is the property of the body or a live tree. He doesn't see the life as the property of the tree body. He sees that the soul is in there, trapped in there by his karma. And not only that, if he's still more elevated, he'll see that Krishna is in the heart of everyone. They'll see the super soul, Not only the individual soul is there, but the super soul is there too. And not only that, if he is very, very still further advanced, he can see that Krishna is there with Srimati Radharani or Lakshmi Narayan, depending upon the depth of his realization. So how wonderful is the vision, the actual vision of a transcendentalist? It cannot be imitated, practically speaking. So Priyavrata Maharaj, as the ruler, he did not expect everyone to be transcendentalists on the highest level, Paramhansa, that everyone would be able to get along and not fight due to the differences in culture and traditions and natures. So therefore, so everyone could live peacefully, he divided the land properly. And then the third verse glorifying Priyavrata. As a great follower and devotee of the sage Narada, Maharaj Priyavrata considered hellish the opulences he had achieved by dint of fruit of activities and mystic power, whether in the lower or heavenly planetary systems or in human society. So he had so much opulence, the king, and he gave it up and became again a renunciant. So he was protected, fully protected in his Krishna consciousness, fully awakened again by the grace of Narada Muni, by the grace of Lord Brahma, by the grace of Krishna. Because he had that desire, he had that earlier taste for spiritual life, vishya vinivartante niraharasya dehina visovarjam visopyasya param dristvanavartate. He could not forget the higher taste, because everything has a taste, every activity has a taste, a particular flavor to it. And naturally, if we have a higher taste, once we drive in a very, very fancy, expensive car, it's very hard to get used to an old jalopy. While you're in an old jalopy and you're driving that and that's all you have, then you're satisfied. But once you drive in a nice car and it doesn't bump around and it starts easily and etc., etc., it's hard to go back fully. So similarly, when one has the taste in Krishna consciousness, if one has tasted that at some point, one may get entangled in material activities, but he'll never give up that taste, and he'll never actually become fully a materialist. Prabhupada's purport. Srila Rupa Goswami has said that the position of a devotee is so super excellent that a devotee does not consider any material opulence worth having, because he has that taste. Because he's always comparing the flavors of his different experiences. And the flavor that he tastes in his service to Krishna, even if he's tasted that for a short time, he wants to live in that. And that desire will ultimately bring him back, regardless of his position. Bring him back where? It will bring him back to the lotus feet of Krishna, to the spiritual world. So there is no situation in the material world worth having. There is only in the material world, there is only the anticipation of something better. But it never gives the flavor. If you sit over here, you'll easily be able to see, because we'll be reading a lot, because Dale has a book right there. There are different, Prabhupada continues, there are different types of opulences on earth, in the heavenly planets and even the lower planetary systems known as Patala. Every place, like even every place, every animal, every situation has a particular opulence and flavor and taste and sweetness, but nothing compares to Krishna consciousness. So So once one's tasted that, never be fully satisfied. A devotee, however, knows that they are all material and consequently he's not interested in them. As stated in the Bhagavad Gita, param dvistana vartate, if you have a superior taste, then the lesser taste won't interest you. Sometimes yogis and jnanis voluntarily give up all material opulences to practice their system of liberation and taste spiritual bliss. However, they frequently fall down because artificial renunciation of material opulence cannot endure. In other words, if we're tasting something sweeter, then it's easy to give up the lesser taste. But if we're not tasting something sweeter, even the lesser taste will attract us again and again. So the trick in Krishna consciousness is to somehow or another always be tasting the sweetness of Krishna consciousness. It has to be alive in our heart. So if one renounces material things but doesn't have the taste of Krishna consciousness, isn't constantly experiencing that, then there's a very good chance that he'll go back to those material things. Because we naturally need taste something that's flavorful. And if we can't find that in the spiritual realm, we'll seek it in the material realm. One must have a superior taste in spiritual life, Prabhupada explains. Then he can give up material opulence. Not give up, take up material life, then spiritual life, some for some time, material life, take up some spiritual life, but when then we're a little bit bored, we go back and taste some of the flavors of material life, and when that doesn't give us happiness, we go back and forth. No. One must have a superior taste in spiritual life. This is really the key. And then we won't want to give that up for anything, but that isn't easy to capture. How to capture it? One has to very sincerely chant Krishna's names. One must have a superior taste in spiritual life, then he can give up material opulence. Maharaj Priyavrata had already tasted spiritual bliss, and therefore he had no interest in any of the material achievements available in the lower, higher, or middle planetary systems. So he was able to give up the king ruling the world and become a renunciant. So that's the end of the Prabhupada's purports and the translations to chapter 1. Now we're going to attempt to go over the entire second chapter. Now, we may refer to the summary. We may not. Now, it's really interesting, this chapter, especially after hearing that last verse and hearing about the life of Priyavrata, how he was a renunciant. And he gave up everything. Then he had to rule, and he got someone entangled, but he gave that up due to the superior taste. So he ruled and ruled and ruled. And then he ultimately went to the spiritual world. Now, his son, he had 7 sons, and they were all given different parts of his kingdom to rule after he himself left. One of the sons was named Agnidra. He had 10 sons, actually, and 3 were Paramhamsas, we read. But Agnidra, we'll read about it in the first verse. After his father, Maharaj Priyavrata, departed to follow the path of spiritual life by undergoing austerities, in other words, after his father, the king, left the kingship for the forest, King Agnidra completely obeyed his order. He took up ruling. Strictly observing the principles of religion, he was very religious. He gave full protection to the inhabitants of Jambadweep as if they were his own begotten sons. So what does that mean? He did his duty very carefully. He was the king, and he took care of the citizens. And this is what it means, actually, to be a ruler. Not to just exact squeeze taxes out of them or one thing or another like that, or get to care for them like a father cares for the children. with such affection. So he had that feeling towards all the citizens, and they loved him in that way. We'll read some of Prabhupada's purport, and we'll skip some of Prabhupada's purport from the beginning. Following the instructions of his father, Maharaj Priyavrata, Maharaj Agnidra ruled the inhabitants of Jambadweep according to religious principles. These principles are exactly contrary to the modern principles of faithlessness. This is the modern principle. Faithlessness and economic rationalism, which means basically that the only problem we have in this world is an economic problem. And if we solve the economic problem by making the rich people richer, then everything, the great benefits will trickle down to the poorer people, the mass of people, and everyone, once their economic situation is solved, will become peaceful and happy, and their life, they'll feel that their life is successful. That is the principle by which modern governments run. Economics first. Economics is first, economics is second, and economics is third. That what people need is economics. And it's true to the degree that without food, without shelter and clothing, and enough of the necessities of life, people really are miserable. So that must be taken care of. But that is not the essence of life. And if one has that, those things, the material accoutrements of life, but doesn't have the spiritual essence of life, he'll never be happy. And his greed will just increase. How much of material necessities is required before someone feels satisfied? Not any amount. It's unlimited. No one will feel satisfied simply with matter, because we are souls, we are spiritual. So Maharaj Agnidra, having spiritual knowledge, ruled by a different principle, not just the economic, materialistic principle that this modern society, contemporary society, is based on, but on spiritual principles. Prabhupada explains a little further down. The king, well, he should not merely act officially. He should be like a father who is always a well-wisher of his sons. Such a father strictly observes whether his sons are performing their duties, and sometimes he also punishes them. Just contrary to the principles mentioned here, the presidents and chief executives in the age of Kali are simply tax collectors who do not care whether religious principles are observed. Indeed, the chief executives of the present day introduce all kinds of sinful activity, especially illicit sex, intoxication, animal killing, and gambling. These sinful activities are now very prominently manifested in India. Although 100 years ago these four principles of sinful life were strictly prohibited in the families of India, they have now been introduced into every Indian family, and every Western family too, and even 100 years ago, practically speaking, in the West, these things were so much minimized, but not completely, but I guess there was always gambling to some degree, and animal killing and intoxication and illicit sex. But so much more subdued, less advertised, less the center of everyone's life. So these sinful activities, Prabhupada explains, are now very prominently manifested in India. Although 100 years ago, these four principles of sinful life were strictly prohibited in the families of India, they have been now introduced into every Indian family. Therefore, they cannot follow religious principles. These are the principles of irreligion, the principles of material misery. If we follow these principles, our material misery is guaranteed, regardless of of what we have, what material wealth we have, if we engage in these activities, we must be suffering. In contrast to the principles of the kings of old, the modern state is concerned only with propaganda for levying taxes and is no longer responsible for the spiritual welfare of the citizens. The state is now callous to religious principles. Srimad Bhagavatam predicts that in Kali Yuga, the government will be entrusted with dasyudharma, which means the occupational duty of rogues and thieves. Modern heads of state are rogues and thieves who plunder the citizens instead of giving them protection. Rogues and thieves plunder without regard for law. But in the age of Kali, as stated in Srimad Bhagavatam, the lawmakers themselves plunder the citizens. They make laws that extract all the wealth from the citizens. The next prediction is to be fulfilled, which is already coming to pass, is that because of the sinful activities of the citizens in the government, rain will become increasingly scarce. Gradually there will be complete drought and no production of food grains. People will be reduced to eating flesh and seeds, and many good spiritually inclined people will have to forsake their homes because they will be too harassed by drought, taxation, and famine. The Krishna consciousness movement is the only hope to save the world from such devastation. So Prabhupada wanted the Krishna consciousness movement to preach very boldly, to be very realized and preach very boldly about religious principles, to become realized and preach. It is the most scientific and authorized movement for the actual welfare of the whole human society. So Agnidra, the king, did this. He ruled in a wonderful way as a loving parent. But as a king, he needed a wife and to have children as well. So desiring to get now... Here we'll get into, there's an incredible contrast between, in this chapter of the Bhagavatam, between his mood, Agnidra's mood. Even though he and Priyavrata, his father, ruled the citizens very well, but Agnidra did not have that taste for renunciation. He did not have the higher taste of spiritual life. It had not been implanted in his heart. Because renunciation has a value, because the value of renunciation is it facilitates our increasing our spiritual taste. Because we cannot experience the sweetness of spiritual life while trying to enjoy material life any more than one can start a fire while at the same time pouring water on it, plenty of water on it. No, you may be trying to start the fire. One may be able to, maybe trying to take to spiritual life. But if he's enjoying, he's pouring water on the spiritual life. So one needs to be somewhat materially renounced to get the fire of spiritual life going, to be able to experience the higher taste. But Agnidra, although the son of Priyavrata, had a different mood than his father. And exactly why will it be explained. Because there's a saying, like father, like son. But it wasn't exactly like father, like son in this case. So, desiring to get a perfect son and become an inhabitant of Pitriloka, a higher realm, Maharaj Agnidra once worshipped Lord Brahma, the master of those in charge of material creation. He went to a valley of Mandara Hill, where the damsels of the heavenly planets come down to stroll. There he collected garden flowers and other necessary paraphernalia, and then engaged in severe austerities. So he engaged in severe austerities and worship, but what was his purpose? His purpose was to gain a beautiful, beautiful heavenly wife. Priyavrata, his father, his purpose was in performing his austerities in worship was completely different. It was to to taste spiritual bliss in the service of Krishna, to become a devotee. So austerity worship, both were there for both of them. Ruling the kingdom very well was there for both of them. But by the end of the chapter, we'll hear how the result of their activities was quite different. So there, he engaged in severe austerities in worship. Prabhupada's purport. We'll read part of it. Since Maharaj Agnidra was the son of a Vaishnava, Priyavrata, a great devotee, he should have desired to be transferred to the spiritual world, Vaikuntha Loka. Why did he desire to be transferred to Pitriloka? Pitriloka is a place where the pleasure on the material level that people experience is very, very sweet and subtle, very different from the pleasures here. That when we think of let's have a good time and let's enjoy something, we think in a gross way. And with a gross mind, a gross consciousness, we cannot actually enjoy other than in a gross way. So by acting in a pure way, a religious way, but still with the desire to enjoy, one can attain very, very subtle and fine tastes. Just like some people, their idea of a good meal is to go to, what's the worst place for a good meal? Huh? That's what everyone was thinking. Yeah. So, but there are a certain class of people who think, boy, that's the greatest. What are we going to do tonight for some fun? Let's go eat some chicken wings or something like that. Somewhere. McFeet. So, but there's other people who maybe like to eat very, very, very much, and not to speak of even vegetarians or devotees, but people who have gourmet, well-developed senses, what do they call a gust? What's the word for a very fine gust? Gust? No, anyway, they like to eat. What's the word?
Gastronomy.
Huh? No. Gastronomy, something like that. Something. So, but a person who has gourmet taste, if he ate in a place like that, he would get sick. So who enjoys more? So the person who eats at McDonald's said, well, I'm enjoying as much as him when he's eating in the finest of restaurants. But actually, it's not a fact. Because when one's taste buds are very, very cultivated and subtle, his ability to enjoy is even more. The same with music. Some people's concept of music is just boom, boom, boom. You know, and the louder, the better. And there's other people who, you know, this is even on the material level, like very fine symphonic music or whatever. So the enjoyment isn't on the same level, because when the volume is up really loud and all you can hear is loud noise, there's no subtlety in it. So subtlety gives the ability to enjoy. So Pitriloka is a place where people who have subtle consciousness, but yet the desire to enjoy, in other words, they're very pious, but yet in desire to enjoy, they can go there. So he desired that. So his basic concept was to enjoy. So, but yet he was the son of a Vaishnava. He should have desired to be transferred to the spiritual world, Vaikuntha Loka. Why then did he desire to be transferred to Pitriloka, a place of material enjoyment? Why didn't he want the sweet taste of Krishna's names as opposed to gourmet cooking? He was above McDonald's, but he wanted gourmet food, but not prasadam, because there's something special in prasadam. He didn't have that subtlety of taste, that spiritual subtlety. So the answer is given by Goswami Giridhar. one of the Bhagavatam commentators. He remarks that Agnidra was born when Maharaj Priyavrata was infatuated by lusty desires. This may be accepted as a fact because sons are begotten with different mentalities according to the time of their conception. According to the Vedic system, therefore, before a child is conceived, the Garbhadhan Sanskara is performed. This ceremony molds the mentality of the father in such a way that when he plants his seed in the womb of his wife, he will beget a child whose mind will be completely saturated with a devotional attitude. At the present moment, however, there are no such Garbhadhan Sanskaras, and therefore people generally have a lusty attitude when they beget children. Especially in this age of Kali, there are no Garbhadhan ceremonies. Everyone enjoys sex with his wife like a cat or a dog. Therefore, according to Shastra injunctions, almost all the people of this age belong to the Sudra category, low, because they're born the time of conception. The mentality of the parents at the time of conception dictates the mentality of the child that will be attracted. The soul with a particular type of karma will be attracted to take birth according to the mentality of the parents at the time of conception. So if everyone's mentality is angry, lusty, greedy, then at the time of conception they'll have that mentality, and the children will be born angry, dissatisfied, hateful. So there are ceremonies to purify the consciousness for the time of conception so that the parents' consciousness will be sweet and spiritual. Not just enjoy, exploit the bodies of the other, but a very, very spiritual, subtle consciousness at the time of conception. So a very exalted child will take his birth at that time. So therefore, according to Shastra conjunction, because this science of properly conceiving a child is not known, almost all the people of this age belong to the Sudra category. Of course, although Maharaj Agnidra had a desire to be transferred to Pitraloka, this does not mean that his mentality was low, like of a Sudra. He was a Kshatriya. So he was exalted materially, but not so much spiritually, which is different between being degraded materially. So he exalted materially, but not spiritually exalted. So Maharaj Agnidra desired to be transferred to Pitraloka, and therefore he needed a wife, because anyone desiring to be transferred to Pitraloka must leave behind a good son to offer yearly pinda or prasad from Lord Vishnu. So to have a good son, Maharaj Agnidra wanted a wife from a family of demigods, very, very exalted wife he wanted. Therefore he went to Mandara Hill, where the women of the demigods generally come to worship Lord Brahma. So understanding King, text 3, Agnidra's desire, the first and foremost powerful created being of the universe, Lord Brahma, selected the best of the dancing girls in his assembly, whose name was Purvachiti, and sent her to the king. So because Krishna, Savasya Chaham, Vidyasana Vista, he is in everyone's heart. So Lord Brahma, trying to serve Krishna by Krishna's grace, he understood what Agnidra's desire was, and he arranged that Purvachiti be sent for the king to become attracted to and ultimately to marry. So the Apsara, a very, very beautiful woman, sent by Lord Brahma, she began strolling in a beautiful park near the place where the king was meditating and worshipping. The park was beautiful because of its dense green foliage and golden creepers. There were pairs of various birds, such as peacocks, and a lake where ducks and swans, all vibrating, very sweet sounds. Thus the park was magnificently beautiful because of the foliage, the clear water, the lotus flowers, and the sweet singing of various kinds of birds. So the king was in a cave meditating, performing austerities. But his purpose was far different from Priyavrata's. He wanted a beautiful wife. So the beautiful wife was sent. The universe, by Krishna's grace, reciprocated. As Purvachiti passed by on the road in a very beautiful style and mood of her own, the pleasing ornaments on her ankles tinkled with her every step. So although he was in meditation, the tinkling of the ankles, our ankle bells, every step, they pierced his meditation. Although Prince Agnidra was controlling his senses, practicing yoga with half-opened eyes, usually they, when we say that the yogi has his eyes half, what do we say? Because if they're half open, they're also half closed. So we usually say he has half closed eyes. But here the emphasis is they were half open. That means he could, so he could, he saw her half. He could see her with his lotus-like eyes. So he was very wonderful too. And when he heard the sweet tinkling of her bangles and ankle bells, he opened his eyes slightly more and could see that she was just nearby. So Prabhupada explains in his purport that a pure devotee, he uses his senses in Krishna's service, and his situation is superior than someone who is trying to renounce being far away from any sensual attraction. So his situation is better. Like a honeybee, the apsara smelled the beautiful, so this beautiful Purvachiti smelled the beautiful and attractive flowers. So she just was wandering around in front of him. There he was, just meditating. And she was walking around, beautiful, smelling all the flowers. She could attract the minds and vision of both humans and demigods with her playful movements, looking very casually. Her shyness, her humility, her glances, and the very pleasing sounds that poured from her mouth as she spoke, and the motions of her limbs. By all these qualities, she opened for Cupid, who bears an arrow of flowers, a path of oral reception into the minds of men. So that means by the sounds that were emanating from her walking, her speaking, the tinkling of her ankle bells, it was Cupid shot an arrow through that into the mind of the king who was meditating. As she breathed, the bees, mad for the taste of her breath, tried to hover about her beautiful lotus-like eyes. Disturbed by the bees, she tried to move hastily, but as she raised her feet to walk quickly, her hair, the belt on her hips and her breasts, which were like water jugs, also moved in a way that made her extremely beautiful and attractive. Indeed, she seemed to be making a path for the entrance of Cupid, who was most powerful. Therefore, the prince, completely subdued by seeing her, spoke to her as follows. So he was gone. His meditation was, let's say his meditation shifted to her. So Prabhupada explains in the purport, when one is controlled by Cupid, or the beauty of women, and this also works on the other way too, women towards men, but especially here, when one is controlled by Cupid, or the beauty of women, he becomes stunned, such as matter, such as stone. There, somewhere in the last year, I saw some. I can't remember where I saw it, but there was somewhere in Europe. There was some shopkeeper, and this famous, beautiful movie actress walked into the shop, and he looked at her, and he just fainted. So one can become stunned like matter, such as stone. Captivated by the material movements of women, he wants to remain in the material world, because the spirit of I can enjoy is awakened by the dealings between men and women and women and men. Thus one's promotion to the spiritual world is checked simply by seeing the beautiful bodily structure and movements of women. Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu has therefore warned all devotees to beware of the attraction of beautiful women and materialistic civilization, because we don't, this goes again for women as well as men, we don't want the enjoying spirit that I can enjoy life to awaken and burn and blaze within the heart. We don't want that, because that will completely check our progress in spiritual life. Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu even refused to see Prataparudra Maharaj because he was a very opulent person in the material world. Lord Chaitanya said in this connection, Niskinjanasya Bhagavad Bhajano Mukhasya, those who are engaged in the devotional service of the Lord because they are very serious about going back home, back to Godhead, should be very careful to avoid seeing the beautiful gestures of women, and should also avoid seeing persons who are very rich. So in other words, one should not meditate upon these things if one is serious about leaving this material world with pure consciousness and going to the spiritual world. And there's a Sanskrit verse and then the English translation. Alas, for a person who is seriously desiring to cross the material ocean and engage in the transcendental loving service of the Lord without material motives, seeing a materialist engaged in sense gratification, or seeing a woman who is similarly interested in is more abominable than drinking poison willingly. Because if one drinks poison, one kills one's body. And if one becomes in a enjoying, lusty mood, greedy mood, then one practically kills one's soul. Prabhupada explains, one who is serious about going back home, back to Godhead, should not contemplate the attractive features of women and the opulence of rich men. Such contemplation, because jayato vishayam pungshan, that by meditating, contemplating the objects of the senses, attachment develops. And then one becomes bewildered, intelligence lost, and one becomes materially contaminated. Such contemplation will check one's advancement in spiritual life. This is an instruction for the serious. Once a devotee is fixed in Krishna consciousness, however, these attractions will not agitate his mind. By definition, he has that higher taste. But this is the reason why Agnidra was there, to find a beautiful wife. So then the prince, he understood this is what he wanted, so therefore, the prince mistakenly addressed the apsara, the beautiful woman, Purvachiti. O best of saintly persons, who are you? Who are you on this hill, and what do you want to do? Are you one of the illusory potencies of the Supreme Personality of Godhead? You seem to be carrying two bows without strings. Your eyebrows are like bows. What is the reason you carry these bows? Is it for some purpose of your own, or for the sake of a friend? She had already shot them into his heart, actually. Perhaps you carry them to kill the mad animals in this forest. We'll read a little of Prabhupada's purport here from the beginning. While undergoing severe penances in the forest, Agnidra was captivated by the movements of Purvachiti, the girl sent by Lord Brahma. As stated in the Bhagavad Gita, kamastarstar vrittigyana, when one becomes lusty, he loses his intelligence. Therefore, Agnidra, having lost his intelligence, could not distinguish whether Purvachiti was a male or a female. He mistook her for a Muniputra, the son of a saintly person in the forest, and addressed her as Munivarja. Because of her personal beauty, however, he could not believe her to be a boy. He therefore began studying her features very intently. First he saw her two eyebrows, which were so expressive that he wondered whether he or she might be the Maya of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Then, this is text 8, Agnidra, observing the glancing eyes of Purvachiti, and said, "My dear friend, you have two very powerful arrows, namely your glancing eyes." Those were the arrows And we use that expression when someone can be pierced by a sharp glance of another, and the eyes were shot by the bows of her eyebrows, the glances. These arrows have feathers like the petals of a lotus flower. Although they have no shaft, they are very beautiful, and they have very sharp, piercing points. They appear very peaceful, and thus it seems they will not be shot at anyone. You must be loitering in this forest to shoot those arrows at someone, but I cannot understand whom. My intelligence is dull, and I cannot combat you. Indeed, no one can equal you in prowess, and therefore I pray that your prowess will be for my good fortune. So he's surrendering to her. He's realized he's met his match. Prabhupada's purport. Agnidra thus began appreciating Purvachitti's powerful glance upon him. He compared her glancing eyes to very sharp arrows. Although her eyes were as beautiful as lotuses, they were simultaneously like shaftless arrows, and Agnidra was therefore afraid of them. He hoped that her glances upon him would be favorable because he was already captivated, and the more captivated he became, the more impossible it would be for him to remain without her. Agnidra therefore prayed to Purvachitti that her glances at him would be auspicious, not futile. In other words, he prayed that she would become his wife, so he knew who she was really. Seeing the bumblebees following Purvachitti, Maharaj Agnidra said, "My dear Lord," he was already acknowledging his position in relationship to her, "the bumblebees surrounding your body are like disciples surrounding your worshipable self." He explains later that he was flattering her to win her over. "They are incessantly chanting the mantras of the Samaveda and the Upanishads, thus offering prayers to you. Just as great sages resort to the branches of Vedic literature, the bumblebees were enjoying the shower of flowers falling from your hair." So he began to praise the bodily beauty of Purvachitti, and he was fully captivated by her, and he spoke sweetly to her. And gradually he asked her whether Lord Brahma had sent her to become his wife. Then we'll go to text 17. Sukadev Goswami continued, "Maharaj Agnidra, whose intelligence was like that of a demigod, knew the art of flattering women to win them to his side. He therefore pleased that celestial girl with his lusty words and gained her favor. Attracted by the intelligence, learning, youth, beauty, behavior, opulence, and magnanimity of Agnidra, the king of Jambadweep, and master of all heroes, Purvachitti lived with him for many thousands of years and luxuriously enjoyed both worldly and heavenly happiness. In the womb of Purvachitti, Maharaj Agnidra, the best of kings, begot 9 sons, namely Nabi, Kimpurusha, Harivarsha, Ilavarta, Ramyaka, Haranmaya, Kuru, Bhadrasva, and Ketumala. Purvachitti gave birth to these 9 sons, one each year, but after they grew up, she left them at home and again approached Lord Brahma to worship him." So Lord Brahma had sent her to Agnidra, and then after her duty had been performed, she went back to worship Lord Brahma. "Because of drinking the breast milk of their mother, the 9 sons of Agnidra naturally had strong, well-built bodies. Their father gave them each a kingdom." Who was their father? Agnidra. "He gave them each a kingdom in different parts of Jambadweep." So he divided his kingdom up. "The kingdoms were named according to the names of the sons. Thus the sons of Agnidra ruled the kingdoms they received from their father." We'll read a little of Prabhupada's purport. The Acharyas specifically mentioned that in this verse, the word Matu Anugrahat, by the mercy of their mother, refers to the breast milk of their mother. In India, it is a common belief that if a baby is fed his mother's milk for at least 6 months, his body will be very strong. Text 22. So Purvachitti left, and the king had his children. After Purvachitti's departure, King Agnidra, his lusty desires not at all satisfied, always thought of her. Therefore, in accordance with the Vedic injunctions, the king, after his death, was promoted to the same planet as his celestial wife. That planet, which is called Pitriloka, is where the Pitas, the forefathers, live in great delight. Purport. So herein is revealed the danger of becoming attracted to something material. Now, if we become attracted to something very subtly material and good, then we get a higher birth, but in the material world. And if we become attracted to something gross and nasty and bad, then we'll take a lower birth. We'll be miserable in this life and take a lower birth. And if we become somehow or another, become attracted to Krishna, then our next birth will be with Krishna in the spiritual world, eternal birth, eternal life. So we tend to be quite careless about what we allow to attract us. So to protect ourselves, we should seriously chant and keep in good association, because who we associate will very much determine what we become attracted to. It's Prabhupada's purport to text 22. If one always thinks of something, he certainly gets a related body after death. Maharaj Agnidra was always thinking of Pitulaloka, the place that his wife had returned. Therefore, after his death, he achieved that same planet, probably to live with her. Bhagavad Gita also says, Yam yam vapi smaram bhavam tejanyante kalevram tam tam evati kanteya saritan bhava bharata. Whatever state of being one remembers when he quits his body, that state he will attain without fail. We can naturally conclude, says Prabhupada, that if we always think of Krishna or become fully Krishna conscious, we can be promoted to the planet of Goloka Vrindavan, where Krishna eternally lives. And the last verse of this chapter. After the departure of their father, the nine brothers married the nine daughters of Meru, named Meru Devi Pratirupa Ugradamristri Lataramya Shyama Nari Bhadra and Devaviti. Thus end the Bhaktivinoda. Purports of the fifth canto, second chapter of the Bhagavatam, entitled The Activities of Maharaj Agnidra. So we can see how different results naturally come according to the activities that one performs. And what determines the activities, the difference of activities that one performs, is the consciousness that one has. So everything will ultimately depend upon the consciousness that one has. So the art is to develop very, very pure consciousness. And the whole Krishna consciousness movement is set up and meant, and the process of Krishna consciousness is set up to help us, to inspire us, to push us, to sometimes frighten us into developing pure consciousness, and to help us avoid developing gross material consciousness especially. Very dangerous. So now the topic will change. That's quite a unique chapter, that one, that second chapter. Now, for the next up to six, so the next four chapters, we'll be talking about Maharaj Rishabdev, who is very opposite. He's a grandson of Agnidra. But he is very, very in a very different mood than Agnidra. Also a king, though. Okay, thank you very much. Any questions or comments? Okay, so if Krishna allows, we will continue tomorrow. Something about the Nabi Maharaj, the son of Agnidra and the father of Rishabdev, and gradually tomorrow we should also hear about, we could do the third chapter tomorrow. Yes, we'll try to do the third chapter tomorrow and start hearing about Maharaj Rishabdev. Srimad Bhagavatam ki jai. Srila Prabhupada ki jai.